Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 265 of Registry Matters. Good evening, fine sir. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
I am doing fan-frickin-tastic. So, you know, we have been doing this thing for like over 5 years now.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
Do you think we can ever get used to you?
I don't know, but I'm hoping so after 5.5 years.
Has it been that long?
Yes.
Is this why I contemplate slitting my wrists every Saturday night?
I'm sure it's a factor.
Well, please, everyone, if you would be so very kind, make sure that you like, subscribe, leave 5-star reviews and all that. You can do that on your podcast app. You can do that over on the YouTube. You can do that wherever it seems most appropriate for how you choose to listen. Like I said, I am a podcast person. I was listening to one while I was cutting the grass today. It's a great way to listen to things. Forget that whole YouTube scam thing. We own this platform. We can never be taken down. YouTube could be like, we don't want you here anymore. So you should do it with a podcast. It's just my opinion. Do you have anything to say on top of that?
Now, you're saying that YouTube, with the vast audience that we have that's approaching many hundreds of thousands now, that they would dare take us down. Are you saying that they would do that?
I could see that our content could cross some line somewhere and we could be taken down. We are as controversial as a person like Alex Jones. Or what's that other knucklehead? Well, we'll just leave it at Alex Jones.
I can't fathom that they would take down a popular program that has the type of ratings that we have.
Please, sir, could you give me a rundown for the evening so that I can feed it into an AI system so that it can write the description for me?
Sure. Tonight we're going to be talking about, we've got some stories. We haven't done much news lately, so we've got some stories from Florida, Georgia, different places around the country. I don't remember what all I threw in here, but the big events are we're going to be talking about your favorite of all subjects, the Interstate Compact. You love that, right?
Oh my God, the most confusing subject on the planet, for real.
So we're going to do a segment on Interstate Compact, and then we've got a case out of the state of Michigan that is back before the Sixth Circuit. And we're going to get into a kind of a deep dive about that case and the likelihood of its success on the issues that have been raised by the attorneys in the case below. And you're going to have fun with that because I know you've read it, what, twice now?
12, 23, 2. What's the difference at this point? I know it almost by heart from memory.
All righty. Well, let's look forward and see how we do. I think that covers what we've got planned for tonight. We're going to try to keep it to an hour because of my fingers are tired at the end of the week in terms of doing this transcript. So we're going to try to keep it compact. So let's roll.
Fantastic. Well, first thing that you put in here, crazy as it is path to voting continues to be murky for Florida ex-felons. This comes from NPR, public-funded media. You know, Larry, I did find a quote that I want to figure out how we can stream it in there. The guy's name is Fred Rogers. Is that who Mr. Rogers is?
I don't know, but I do remember Mr. Rogers from NPR.
So, well, from public broadcasting or whatever, and he testified before Congress about why we need funding for public media because of its non-biasedness. Anywho, need to figure out how we can fit that in here. Anyway, so this is from NPR. Nearly a million Floridians who have finished prison time for a felony remain disenfranchised despite a 2018 ballot measure that was a constitutional amendment that promise to restore their voting rights. And as this year's legislative session wraps up, advocates say Florida lawmakers still haven't done anything to provide clarity for the formerly incarcerated who want to regain their rights. The reason so many people remain disenfranchised stems from rules Republicans added after voters approved a ballot measure. And again, this was to update. It was Amendment Number 4 off of their constitution that prevented anybody with a felony from voting. So in 2019, legislators passed a law requiring returning citizens to pay all fees and fines associated with their sentence before they can vote again.
Yes, I do recall that. We've talked about it before, and according to the story, lawmakers never created a system to find out who owes what, says Fintress Driscoll, the Democratic leader of the Florida House. Quote, "We have been asking for a database," she said. "Just let people know whether or not they have fines and fees. Let them know how to pay them. Let them know whether they're eligible to register to vote," end of quote. The funny thing is, that was not in the constitutional amendment. That was something that was passed by law, but the constitutional amendment was a little bit vague. It said until all obligations. So the Republicans who run Florida decided that all obligations could include fines, fees, and restitution, anything they could tack on. And apparently there's no system to track that.
That seems weird. What do you think that it will get fixed?
I don't think it's likely to be fixed. I think that the partisan nature of it, the Republicans have this fear. It's an unfounded fear that all these voters are going to align themselves with the Democrat Party. I don't see that as being a realistic fear, but that's the fear they have. So I don't see them wanting to put a million new Democratic voters on the rolls in Florida.
Driscoll goes on and says, issues around voting eligibility for the formerly incarcerated came to a head last year when the state's newly elected, created Election Crimes Unit announced a slew of voter fraud and arrests. We all watched in horror as Governor Ron DeSantis had 20 people arrested, she said. He had returning citizens who believed that they had registered to vote in a valid way. He had them arrested. Those 20 individuals weren't eligible to vote because they had been convicted under murder or PFR type offenses, which exempted them from getting their rights back even if they had paid their fines and fees. Despite that, most of them were given voter registration cards. Local election officials said they were relying on the state to make sure voters were eligible.
That's really sad because that's kind of what we do when we go in to register to vote. They take the information and they run it through various machinations that we're not familiar with, but they have access to a number of databases. And I have some connection to the election system because I work for someone who was formerly the election director for the whole state. And the assumption is that they wouldn't give you a voter card unless you were eligible. At least that would be my assumption. What would yours be?
Well, I was just going to ask you, can you please dig into voting is handled at the county level, as far as I understand it. But then who's responsible for making sure that you are an eligible voter? Is that like the DMV?
Well, the way I understand it, and I'm not the former election director, but the way I understand it, the county feeds this stuff to a state database that's available to county clerks. Here, the registrar for voters is the county clerk of the county, and they feed that information, and then it tells them if they are prohibited for whatever reason. And if they issue you a voter identification card, if it arrives in the mail, you would assume that you're eligible to vote. The average person would make that assumption, but it is state rules, but they're administered locally.
Wouldn't this fall under the category of, I'm going to forget this term. Catherine Carpenter used it. It's when laws are, the punishment is very benign, but you don't know the consequences, like speeding. Oh, I didn't know. You're guilty anyway. I forgot the term. I asked you like a month ago and you're like, I don't remember.
Oh, you're talking about strict liability.
Strict liability. So wouldn't this fall under something like that?
Well, the way the governor of Florida interpreted it, yes, but that's just the governor of Florida's interpretation. You can always arrest someone. That doesn't mean you can secure a conviction. If I were if I were defending that person, I would argue that the statute is a defective because you would assume that you're eligible to vote if a card's issued, and you would not have known this stuff. It was not a knowing commission of a felony, and for a felony offense to be, I think it was a felony, if you're going to convict someone of a felony, they have to know that they're breaking the law. That would be my argument, that you can't have the strict liability But unfortunately, we do have strict liability when it comes to certain PFR type offenses.
Right. But in this case, is this something that you would go to prison for? And I don't want to diminish being there for 30 days and missing car payments and rent payments and losing your job. I don't want to diminish that. But is this, like, what is the punishment for this?
It can be a much longer prison sentence. If it's a felony, it's going to carry more than 30 days. So people could go away for a long period of
true.
Time.
The other, is this a problem? Is this a non-existent problem? Because there's all these reports, all these people, you know, the whole Fox News settlement thing of voter fraud, that there's no documentation of any voter fraud. Is this something in search of that problem?
It is indeed. Now, of course, voter fraud happens. Some of it is intentional and some of it is unintentional. For example, people are busy in their lives and they move and they go back to their former precinct to vote, even though they don't live there. That's their registered yep. address, but they would go sign in. Now, we don't do it that way because you can vote at any vote center here. We're not tethered to a precinct anymore, but many states are still tethered to the precinct. But even if you're not tethered to a precinct, you have to give the address where you're registered. And therefore, that person is actually not eligible at that location, but they are an eligible voter. But very little of it is fraud where the person's trying to vote multiple times. They never show any evidence of that there's this mass conspiracy to create votes. And there just hasn't been surfaced. I mean, we had an investigation here some years ago when we had our only Republican Secretary of State since the state has existed. They investigated thousands. They pulled down thousands of votes, and they found out that every one of those suspect votes were legitimate. There was no fraud. But yeah, it is a solution in search of a problem. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be on guard against it, because it would diminish the voters' reliance on a system if there are people voting who are not eligible to vote, or there are people voting who don't exist. And the funny thing that people do is they run down and register fictitious names, and sometimes those get through all the screening and they say, "See, this shows that it's a corrupt system. I registered Donald Duck."
Or my dog got registered. Okay, let us move along to Michigan. I got it. Very good. There was the wrong title thing was in the place. Gotcha. Let us cover Michigan PFRs seek individual liability for enforcement of vacated rules. You want to talk about this case pending before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals from Michigan? Please tell us what is up with this on the latest and greatest.
Sure. John Doe plaintiffs, that's the name of the plaintiffs in the case, represent a class seeking monetary damages for alleged violations of the 14th Amendment and the Ex Post Facto Clause of the United States Constitution. Plaintiffs say their 42 United States Code 1983 claims arose out of the Michigan State Police's enforcement of allegedly unconstitutional provisions of the Michigan PFR Registration Act, otherwise known as SORA.
What are they looking for here? What are they seeking?
They want money. The plaintiffs claim that they were subjected to due process violations, retroactive punishment, and First Amendment infringement, and they suffered significant economic loss and emotional harm.
Would you be so kind if I give you some background? Would that be okay with you?
Yes. You've read this case 20 times, right?
Yes. Like I said, I'm going to kind of do it from memory. Here is some background. Michigan enacted SORA in 1994. It established a confidential database containing information about PFRs that was available only to law enforcement. The Michigan State Legislature has amended SORA numerous times, and the problems really cascaded with SORA in 2006 amendments. Those changes increased reporting requirements for registrants, introduced a registration fee, prohibited registrants from working, residing, or loitering, basically existing within 1,000 feet of a school and all those other places. And it created a program where members of the public could be notified electronically when a PFR moved into a particular zip code. And I vaguely recall that there were some more challenges that came up around 2011.
Yes, they made SOAR changes in 2011, and they significantly altered the structure of the law, and that was to achieve AWA compliance. The statute assigned certain offenses to certain tiers based on the legislature's perception of the offense's dangerousness. It did not factor in an individualized determination of the offender risk. Tier levels dictated registration and compliance obligations in terms of years. Tier 1, 15 years. Tier 2, 25 years. And Tier 3, life. The 2011 amendments also subjected registrants to the frequent inconvenience of reporting to law enforcement in person whenever they changed residences or employment, enrolled or even unenrolled as a student, changed names, registered a new email address or other internet identifier, or wished to travel for more than 7 days, or bought or began to use a vehicle, or even cease ownership of a vehicle. Basically, anything that you did that fell within the zone of registration, you had to do it. You had to report in person to make those changes.
Plaintiffs in this case alleged that SORA's continued enforcement after previous rulings significantly impacted each of them. They say this impact reaches far beyond the stigma of simply being identified as PFRs on a public registry. Plaintiffs brief detailed numerous instances where they were required to comply with invalidated provisions of SORA. Did the court find their allegations compelling?
Now, folks, we're talking about the trial court at this point, and no, the trial court did not.
The plaintiffs argued that all defendants are individually liable for constitutional violations resulting from MSP's enforcement of SORA, and that would be Michigan State Police, I guess?
Correct.
They asserted that despite having knowledge of the violations, defendants failed to issue any directive, policy memoranda, or other form of communication instructing subordinates that the enforcement of 2006 and 11 amendments was unconstitutional. That does seem compelling to me.
Well, it is compelling, but as we get to later, not compelling enough. They also stated they believe defendants encouraged and implicitly authorized the continued violations of plaintiffs' rights by the Michigan State Police and other law enforcement agencies. The problem is they said they believed it, and they did not prove the assertion. It's difficult to prove things without going to trial unless the opposing party enters into a joint stipulation. Now, can you imagine that the state of Michigan would enter into a joint stipulation on any of these important facts that were not proven out?
No, I guess not.
Well, that's one of the downfalls of summary judgment. Keep going.
Oh, this is summary judgment, is it?
Yes.
So the state asks that the case be dismissed. And what is the legal standard when a motion for dismissal is filed?
Well, since I'm not a lawyer, I'm going to always pivot to the trial judge. The trial judge said, to survive a motion to dismiss, a complaint must contain sufficient factual matter, accepted as true, meaning the court has to accept the complaint as true, to state a claim for relief that is plausible on its face. And you can find that in the order of dismissal on page 14. Dismissal under Rule 12b-6 is warranted only if it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of the claims that would entitle him or her to relief.
And you said that the case is pending before the Sixth Circuit. This means that things did not go well at this lower court level?
That would be an understatement, to say the least. They certainly did not go well.
The trial court identified several issues with the complaint. They will have to overcome the issues with the statute of limitations, sovereign immunity, and qualified immunity if they are to turn the ship around in the Sixth Circuit. I almost said circus. Do you think they can recover?
Extremely unlikely.
You are so doom and gloom. SORA was declared unconstitutional under the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment and the ex post facto clause by several federal court rulings. The list on page 4 of the district court opinion. And that's the list that's on page four. Why was the law enforced after that?
Well, because the court did not order the state to cease enforcement of SORA. Instead, they permitted the legislature time to rewrite the law without the unconstitutional provisions. You remember that? When they said, we will give you time to legislate, that's what happened.
I do remember that. You also predicted, correctly, that they would not legislate until a date certain for the registry going down was established by the court.
I did predict that, and that is in fact what happened. The Michigan legislature eventually passed, and the governor signed Public Act 295 of the 2020 session. It was known also as House Bill 5679, which repealed certain provisions and amended other provisions of Michigan SORA. These changes took effect on March 24, 2021. That was 5 years after the Sixth Circuit found that the law was unconstitutional.
So in 2016, Doe's won before the Sixth Circuit addressed only the retroactivity of the amendments. The court held that retroactive application of the 2006 and 2011 SOAR amendments violated the ex post facto clause. This ruling made it unlawful for the state to apply any 2006 or 2011 amendments to Doe's 1 plaintiffs who were convicted before the effective dates of the amendments. How did they continue to enforce this of from the unconstitutional law point of view?
Again, because there was no order from the court to stop enforcing it. The court didn't want to just have the registry go dark. So they gave, since they're not in the legislative business, they left it up to the legislature to fashion a constitutional law. But the courts are not political creatures by and large. There was no rush to do that. You're sitting in the legislature. Imagine this. You do have some protection from the court by that order, but who wants to be the first one to say, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to see how we can peel back some of these requirements on PFRs. You're just not going to do that. So there was no rush to do that.
So I'm going to make my own analogy that I keep hearing about this, the redistricting stuff. And then the court says that this is gerrymandering and you can't do this. But the court doesn't gerrymander. They just say, you guys have to go write different maps, because the legislature is the group that rewrites the maps. So then they come back with new maps and they try this all again. Is that a fair analogy?
Very fair. It's, in fact, that's what often happens on rare occasions when they're loggerheads and cannot come up with district maps. Courts have been known to draw maps, but it's extremely rare. They're not in the legislating business.
And so that's essentially what is happening here. They said, you can't do this. We're not telling you what you can do, but you can't do this.
Correct.
All right. And then there was another case, otherwise known as Doe's 1, days after the Sixth Circuit decision in Doe's 1. Six different John Doe plaintiffs filed a class action complaint challenging the constitutionality of SORA on the same grounds as Doe's 1. On February 14th, hey, happy Valentine's Day, of 2020, Doe's 2 held that SORA 2011 amendments declared unconstitutional under the ex post facto clause in Doe's 1, and they could not be severed from the state's statute. It concluded that no SORA provisions could apply retroactively to members of the ex post facto subclass, and that would be individuals whose offenses occurred prior to July 1 of 2011, the enactment of the SORA amendments. And did that finally end enforcement?
I think it finally did shortly after that, yes.
So do you mind if we go through their individual arguments?
Yes, I do look forward to that because they all got pretty well demolished, but let's do it.
All right. The state asserted that the plaintiffs are time barred by the statute of limitations. And so from the time that it's enacted, they had 5 years, some number before. If they didn't do it at that time, like, you're just doomed from the start.
That's correct. The judge stated,
okay,
plaintiffs did not respond to defendants and therefore concede that fact. Given the date they filed suit and the statute of limitations defense, any claims for damages that occurred prior to August 17th, 2018 are time barred.
Can that be overturned on appeal?
Not likely. I don't see how you could, sitting as a tribunal, I don't see any way that you can overcome the law. The statute of limitations is there. That would be the ultimate of legislating for the bench to say, well, I look at that thing there and it says that, but the hell with that. I'm going to rule the other way. I just don't see how that can be overturned.
There is the issue of supervisory control. Plaintiffs allege failure to supervise the MSP by the governor. That doesn't sound like a bad argument. Is that will that be overturned on appeal?
Well, a supervisory official's failure to supervise, control, or train a subordinate officer is not actionable unless the supervisor either encouraged the specific incident of misconduct or in some other way directly participated in it. And that's what the trial judge decided. And the trial judge cited Petros versus City of Memphis, and that's a Sixth Circuit binding case from 2016. I don't see how they're going to overcome that. It's the law of the circuit.
So I do also see that. And then the judge also stated that it is not enough for the plaintiff to allege that the defendant's supervisors were sloppy, reckless, or negligent in the performance of their duties. A plaintiff must allege that, considering the information the defendants possessed, the offending officer's failure to take adequate precautions amounted to deliberate indifference to plaintiff's constitutional rights. You don't think they can overcome that one either?
I do not. Page 18, I'll refer to that. The court stated, in short, to survive dismissal, plaintiffs must plausibly allege facts indicating the defendants, one, had a duty or authority to act, and two, were each personally involved implicitly, authorized, knowingly acquiesced, or approved the continued enforcement of SORA after it was declared unconstitutional, and three, they must plausibly allege that defendants' conduct caused injury. Again, it's hard to do that without a trial. You don't have any evidence that I'm aware of, and I doubt the state stipulated to any of those things. I can't imagine why they would.
Let's move over to sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity, the court stated, the defendants raise a strong 11th Amendment sovereign immunity case. Defendants say that notwithstanding the wording in the complaint, this lawsuit is barred under the 11th Amendment because the state of Michigan is the real party in interest and plaintiffs seek the payment of damages at the state's expense. What did the trial court decide here? I need to play the laugh track?
It might not be a bad place to play it. The trial court held that defendants are correct. If an action is really against the state, even if it's not named as a defendant, the state is the real party in interest, and it is entitled to invoke sovereign immunity. And they cited Lewis versus Clark from, I'm not sure where that case is from. Oh, that's a Supreme Court case from 2017. Not only that, but 1983 actions cannot be prosecuted against a state or state official in their official capacities. I didn't read those cases. I don't know what they said, but that's what the trial judge relied on. And I'm certain that she or her law clerk did read them.
Plaintiffs also allege that defendants are liable because they failed to terminate the unconstitutional application of SORA by their subordinates or issued an executive order, policy, directive, or other communication instructing the Michigan State Police and other law enforcement agencies that the continued enforcement of the 2006 and 2011 SORA amendments was unconstitutional. Can you not admit to me, please admit, that this judge is wrong?
I cannot do that. The judge is relying on controlling case law and the Constitution. Both of those cases I cited, one was from the U.S. Supreme Court and one was from the Sixth Circuit. They're both binding because this is the Sixth Circuit. The 11th Amendment bars federal suits by private parties when the ultimate judgment will be paid from the state treasury. And the trial judge cited Tucker versus Ohio Department of Rehab and Corrections, and that's again a Sixth Circuit case. A damage award for the state's unconstitutional enforcement of a law would likely be paid from the state treasury and impact state policy to be implemented by current and future governors and Michigan State Police directors. The judge is following the law. Now, which is it that you guys want, Andy? You want judges that follow the law, or do you want judges who invent the law on the bench? I'm getting confused tonight.
I want it to be whichever way I want it at the time that it benefits me most at that time.
Okie dokie.
So, I'm sure you're optimistic that this will be overturned on appeal.
I don't see that issue being overturned on appeal either, no.
All right. You are Mr. Doom and Gloom tonight. Now, let's look at qualified immunity. And I've heard you pontificate in the past about qualified immunity. Qualified immunity shields government officials from liability for civil damages unless it is proven that the conduct violated clearly established statutory or constitutional rights. How is that determination made, whether a right is clearly established?
Well, the court stated, in inquiring whether a constitutional right is clearly established, we must look first to decisions of the Supreme Court, and they're speaking of the U.S. Supreme Court, then to decisions of the Court of Appeals, then to other courts within our circuit, and finally to decisions of other circuits. And then the court eloquently pointed out, a single district court opinion is not enough to pronounce a right is clearly established, established for purpose of qualified immunity.
Can the plaintiffs prevail on qualified immunity on appeal?
Again, not likely. The trial court held it was not until August 26th of 2021. That's the date that those two judgment that the unconstitutional of SORA amendments under the First and 14th Amendments grounds, that's when it became clear, a clearly established constitutional violation. So everything that happened prior to then, no, you cannot recover from this, in my opinion.
What about on ex post facto ground, the Doe's one decision should have served as a notice and the rights to be free of ex post facto punishment. Wouldn't that have been clear then? How can you spin this one that way?
Well, you're correct. It should have put people on notice. But on page 31, the trial judge acknowledges that. The trial judge said plaintiff's ex post facto rights were clearly established by the time of Doe's one. In 2016, the judge then stated a reasonable officer would have known that the retroactive application of SORA by the state of Michigan violated the ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution. In summary, though, defendants would not be entitled to qualified immunity on that count for claims that arose after August 25th, 2016. But because of the impact of the statute of limitations, plaintiffs cannot claim damages for any injuries that they suffered. So remember, look at the dates. There was a gap there when they were on notice, but then they let the statute of limitations run. But even if those claims cannot move forward because of other defenses, on which she said, but even those claims cannot move forward because of other defenses, which defendants have prevailed. So yes, they're screwed.
Going along, senior U.S. Circuit Court Judge Danny Boggs, a Ronald Reagan appointee, pointed out much of the complaint filed by Matuka's clients was written in the passive voice, and they asked the attorney why the individuals who directly enforced the registration requirements were not named as defendants. That turns into a whack-a-mole problem. Matuka said, no one from the top of the authority with the authority to do so said, this needs to stop or this is unconstitutional. Was this a failure or a bad strategy?
Not sure I can say with my limited information, but I can say that for whether it was bad strategy, it's going to probably result in an outcome that we're not going to be happy with. It's going to surprise me if they turn this around.
And of course, I'm going to ask you what happens next.
Well, this case had oral arguments before the Sixth Circuit last week. It's been submitted. As I refer to it, the case is now submitted. And so we're waiting on the decision. I remember we waited for how many years from the 11th Circuit? We waited for that decision from the 11th Circuit with McGuire. We could be waiting for some period of time, or it could come out within 3 months. Who knows?
And so that is at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Is that correct?
You're correct.
Okay. And I mean, do they use similar terms to the Supreme Court where they say they grant cert? Is that the same sort of terminology?
No, when you go to the Court of Appeals, that's a right that you have. So they don't get to say, no, we won't hear your case. They can flush it.
Oh.
But that's a right you have to your first level of appellate review.
I see. Okay. Hey, let me take a quick detour. I got a question for you regarding when you say I'm going to take it straight from the judge or from the opinion because you're not a lawyer. I hear reporters on news programs, they're not attorneys, and they speak of what was said, but they also fill in their opinion as being legal experts of sorts. Why can't you?
I could, but I'm trying to give people less things to shoot at, saying that this guy's practicing law without a license. If I'm reading, I have been told by our chief disciplinary counsel several times that I can always read the law. I can always read a judicial opinion. But when I start interpreting it, then I'm getting into a grayer area. So therefore, if I let the judge speak, then I say, look, the judge said it. I didn't say it.
But you're not practicing. You're not advising a person to do a thing. You're whatever. All right. That's a whole different enchilada that we would have to slice and dice at a later date. And yesterday was Cinco de Mayo. So there you go.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Register Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Shall we move over to this main event of things that I had confused a moment ago?
Yeah, this main event comes because of you and all the commotion you make about Interstate Compact. And then I got this ugly message from a person who fouled up. And I said, you know, what a great segment this will make because Andy loves Interstate Compact stuff. And this fits right in because of the violation. As we go through it, people are going to, of course, I'll use the term funny, but I doubt you'll say it's funny.
Every time we go through it, Larry, I think I understand it this way. And then you explain it as it is that way. And I try to adjust to go that way. And then the next time, I think that you have switched me back to thinking about it a different way. Every time we do this, I end up confused again. So we are going to go back to, of course, one of the most confusing issues, which is the Interstate Compact. We have not discussed Interstate Compacts in a while, or issues related to those who are transferring via the Interstate Compact in quite a while. Do you mind if we do that again, please?
I don't mind, because this is one I really don't have to do a lot of prep on, but I did do prep to plug in the facts of this person's case, because I actually used it for something I wrote for the Legal Corner column.
And why should we listen to you on this specific subject? Since you're not a lawyer, you're just Larry. Why should we listen to you on this subject?
Because I've been recognized as an expert in this, and I have been engaged by entities in the state to train attorneys related to this issue. So therefore, you should listen to me on this.
I see. The issue was communicated to you in the form of a question to the Legal Corner, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a NARSOL segment of the newsletter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. The writer asked, how does New Mexico ignore its own laws when New Mexico law mandates a review after 5 years to determine if supervision should continue? He was transferred to New Mexico from Arizona, and they did not provide him a review hearing. I've heard you say that PFRs in New Mexico are entitled to review after 5 years of supervision.
They are. When they were convicted in New Mexico, he was not.
Oh, God, it's one of these things where you start murking up everything. All right, he stated, they never reviewed me while I was there. If they had, I would have gotten off before they caught me with an unauthorized electronic device. Does he have a point?
He does have a point, but he has a point on the electronic device. He shouldn't have had that in his possession, but he does not have a point regarding the review hearing, because he's not entitled to one. He has lifetime supervision imposed by Maricopa County, Arizona. New Mexico cannot give him a review hearing on that.
We really need to take a deep dive regarding the power each state has over an offender who is supervised pursuant to the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision, which is also known as ICOTS, is what I call it. This continues to confuse me, so please debunk me, Larry. Well, deconfuse me.
That is why I am here. What do you want to know specifically? Registration versus supervision requirements can be confusing. These are two completely separate and distinctly different in terms of which state controls.
So please make it more simpler. Dumb it down for me.
Okay. A person who has been sentenced to a penalty for criminal conduct is paying his or her debt to the people of the state where the conviction occurred. Just to clarify, it's the people who make the laws. And in this case, it's the people of Arizona whose laws he broke. This means that only the state of Arizona can reduce or eliminate the remainder of his lifetime supervision.
But New Mexico does have a law that PFRs are entitled to review after 5 years. Does New Mexico get to ignore their own law?
Well, actually, they have ignored that law even for people who were convicted in New Mexico. But that's an issue that's unrelated to this guy, because he's not entitled to that provision because his penalty did not come from New Mexico. He has to take all of his issues with his penalty back to Arizona. A person's not entitled to that hearing if New Mexico did not impose the sentence. Wouldn't it be great if a person could extinguish their penalty for committing a crime at one state by moving to another state?
I think that sounds like a great plan. We would all buy stock in U-Haul so that we could capture all of the people moving around from state to state. But this becomes confusing because the receiving state, which is New Mexico in this case, likely imposed some special conditions that were not originally imposed by the state of Arizona. And I thought you said that the state of conviction controls the sentence.
I have said that numerous times. But nevertheless, there are always exceptions. An offender who requests to be transferred through the interstate compact is obligated to abide by any special conditions imposed by the receiving state. That power is specifically in the ICAOS and is intended to eliminate inconsistent supervision of offenders with similar convictions. Can you imagine how difficult that would be? Say you've got a caseload of 60, and say of that 60, none of them are from other states. And if you had to have a flowchart of what you could do, well, this one has a curfew at 9, and this one has a curfew at 6, and this one has a, and you couldn't do that. So therefore, if it's a standard condition that would be imposed on a PFR in New Mexico, New Mexico can impose that special condition, even though Arizona did not. But that does not enlarge the punishment. It makes the punishment a little bit more rigorous, but it doesn't enlarge the. If he had 10 years probation, he still has 10 years probation. Doesn't change that. If he had a $10,000 fine, he still has a $10,000 fine. If he has $100,000 in restitution, he still has $100,000 in restitution. Those factors, the actual punishment cannot be changed.
Okay, my head's starting to spin. You're doing doublespeak again. Which state controls the sentence?
The state of conviction is in control of the sentence. Only that state can reduce any aspect of the punishment. The receiving state can add special conditions to the supervision, but the caveat is that the special condition must be conditions that would have been imposed had the person been convicted of a similar offense in their state. Special conditions do not alter the sentence itself, but it is reasonable for you to believe that if New Mexico can change your conditions of supervision, they can also modify and or terminate your supervision, but they cannot. No state can increase or decrease the term of your punishment or levy additional fines or restitution. This would be usurpation of the sending state's powers, and the receiving state just does not have that authority. Modification of the length of an offender's sentence is exclusive within the domain of the state of conviction.
Clarify what is considered punishment.
Well, that would be easy. The term of imprisonment, if there was a term of imprisonment imposed, any post-prison supervision or probation would be considered punishment. Any fines or restitution would also be considered punishment. The receiving state cannot alter those aspects of the sentence. In other words, those are fixed by Arizona in his case. Arizona fixed lifetime supervision. There's not a thing New Mexico can do about that. The only thing New Mexico could do would be recommend that he's been stellar under supervision and that he be terminated. They're not going to do that, but they could do that. But that's all they could do in terms of lessening his penalty. Same thing with any fines or restitution. That's all within Arizona's hands.
What about supervision fees?
Now, that, again, will make your head spin because the receiving state does control supervision fees because they're providing the supervision service. However, supervision fees one would have paid in the state of conviction no longer apply when the person is on interstate compact, meaning the state of Arizona doesn't get to charge him fees as well. When they turn loose of him and send him to out of state, then their supervision has terminated other than he's on someone's desktop to communicate with the state where he's serving his probation. And they don't have any direct contact with him, so they don't get the money. New Mexico gets the supervision fee.
And then I guess, what about registration stuff, PFR registration? Who do you register with? To whom do you register?
Now, therein is where we start getting complicated again. Registration obligations are determined and controlled by the state one is residing in rather than the state of conviction. This means that New Mexico would have had the final say regarding the duration and frequency of registration while he was supervised in New Mexico.
What about now then?
Well, as I understand it, based on the communication, he's back in prison, but say they let him out because an unauthorized device may not yield a long prison time in Arizona. But now that he's already in Mexico, he must comply with Arizona's registration laws upon his release unless he is transferred again.
Does he have plans to re-return? Will New Mexico accept him again?
He did mention that he would like to come back, and they will do all they can to deny him. And beyond that, it would be foolish to return because they will target him for revocation again if he does get to come back. It would seem like that he would have learned his lesson from being here the first time, that these people are not going to go easy on him. He's not going to get cakewalk, and I don't know why he'd want to come back.
Just a quick comment in chat. The moral of the story, don't leave the state till you're off of supervision. But in this guy's case, he was going to be on it for life. So like, you're just supposed to shut down your whole living apparatus if you're on lifetime supervision? All right. Well, you have pontificated that at the time of conviction, the court must apprise the person of their duty to register. And as far as in my mind, this is where it gets super muddy. Since he was informed of his duty to register, can the failure to comply with registration result in a violation of your supervision and a new criminal charge?
It definitely can do both. This means the person who has been transferred out on interstate compact can be sent back and face revocation of their supervision for failing to comply. So failing to comply, since the Arizona court told him when they apprised him of that duty, that's something that can also constitute a violation of his terms of supervision. So New Mexico could say, gee, we're having trouble with him. He hasn't been registering. And Arizona can initiate a revocation proceeding. And at the same time, New Mexico can file a criminal charge as well for failing to comply. But that's a brand new criminal charge. And he is subject to the nuances of the registration scheme in New Mexico. And all the paperwork they handed him in Arizona that told him what he had to do to register, that was null and void when he got to New Mexico. And if he's tripped up in New Mexico, he could be facing both a revocation and a criminal charge in New Mexico.
Do you know the acronym, the shortened version, ELI-5?
Doesn't come to mind.
Okay, well, I'm going to use it here. We need to wrap up this segment, so can you please provide a simple explanation of the difference, which is equivalent to ELI-5? Explain it like I'm five, please.
So, okay, registration of PFRs is a civil regulatory scheme and not considered part of the person's actual punishment, even though the penalties for failure to comply are extremely harsh. And FYP recognizes, despite the civil non-punitive label, the process of registration and maintaining compliance with many of the restrictions is akin to punishment. In fact, some states have registration requirements that impose more restrictions than the person would have had when they were serving their court-imposed sentence. You could have more obligations as a registrant than you had while you were being supervised as a sexual offender. We get that, but it's still not a part of your actual punishment. It's a duty that flows from the conviction, and therefore, it's sole and separate from the punishment. You have to get over it. Until we prove it's punishment, it's not.
Which would be equivalent to buying a car in some place that doesn't have any or limited smog controls, and then you move to one, California, that makes you have super tight emissions. It's a civil regulatory scheme. It's not punishment. If you don't want to comply with the punishment side of it, then don't move there. If you don't want to have your car having the tailpipe thing not put out the stinky smoke, then don't move to California.
That is correct. That's probably one of the stricter states, and I'm thinking some of the compact states up in the Northeast, New Jersey would probably be similar. They wouldn't let allow a lot of junkers to come there because they have too many people cramped into too small of a space.
Yep. And then that means that the sending state is not in control of PFR registration unless the person does not comply with the receiving state's law.
That is correct. While the person's under supervision and they're not in the state that convicted them, they are not in control of registration. But that doesn't mean that you cannot have a violation that can be punished in both states. So in conclusion, the person's actual punishment, which is probation parole, remains forever in the hands of the sending state. Registration is in the hand of the states where the person's living at any point. The crossover is that failure to comply with requirements of registration can trigger a revocation in the sending state as well as a new criminal charge in the receiving state. If you don't want to have the thing stacked, you better comply with the registration in the state that you're sent to. That's your chief thing to do. Forget about what they told you in Vermont that you have to mail this form in once a year. When you go to Ron DeSantis's Florida, that goes that goes into the garbage dumpster as soon as you get into Florida. You will do what DeSantis tells you to do, or you'll face a long prison sentence in Florida. And then when he gets done with you, he will hand you back to Vermont, and they can decide to do nothing. They can decide to give you credit time served, but you can end up in a conundrum in both states.
All right. I'm going to stick with what I already think I know in my head, and the people in chat are also equally confused. So we'll leave that where it is, and we have a couple more news items to cover. Unless there's anything else you would like to say about this particular subject in general.
Not about this subject, but I'd like to double back to a question that I didn't answer last week from at the very beginning of the show. We took a detour and I didn't answer the guy and asked, why is it, if it's a regulatory scheme, why are the penalties so severe? And there's no correlation. You can't make that quantum leap. Failure to register for the draft carries up to 5 years in prison. Nobody ever gets to 5 years for failure to register for the draft, but it is a maximum penalty. I did the research recently. The penalty, you cannot say, well, because the penalty is harsh, that makes it a punitive scheme just in and of itself, because penalties can be imposed or they can be probated. And he's looking at it incorrectly. Well, it's a serious crime. That makes it punitive. No, it doesn't. You can do serious damage with violating civil regulatory schemes. You can go to jail for a number of civil regulatory schemes that you don't comply with, including serving bad food, not handling it properly. You can be shut down and you can be incarcerated. Seldom happens, but it can.
I knew a woman who got, and I'm going to get the details all screwy, but the material handling data sheet, MH, whatever it is, this individual had an employee not follow it correctly. And because she was the supervisor or business owner, she went to federal prison for like 2 or 3 years. And of course she was pissed off because she lost her gun rights, but because of a civil regulatory scheme of not handling chemicals correctly, she had to go serve time for it. Something along those lines. I might have some details incorrect, but that's what she did.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's do these last two. Get out of here.
Well, I have a quick question for you that is a sort of legal and current events news oriented, that you may have heard that some of the individuals that were at the peaceful protest at the Capitol were convicted in the last handful of days. Did you hear about that?
I've heard some rumors of that.
Okay. Well, here's my question. Their crimes to me seem exorbitant. I don't want to debate with anybody whether they, you know, false flag this. I don't give a shit. But they are convicted of this. And the maximum sentence that they can serve for attempting to take over the country or overthrow the government, whichever you want to word it, the maximum penalty they could get is 20 years. And some of our people get sentences of hundreds of years. And in my brain, it seems like overthrowing the government is worse and they can only get a maximum of 20 years. You want to straighten me out on this concept?
I think I'm going to duck and dodge that one.
We've talked about like the parity of different kinds of sentences. And you said you just really can't compare them because, I mean, we are a system of laws by the people, and what we choose to make a sentence for someone for doing a thing is just whatever it is. And that's what this sentence is.
So, yeah, I think I'm going to leave that can of worms alone.
You are just, you're whatever. All right. So here's a story from CNN. Oklahoma PFR fatally shot his wife, her 3 kids and 2 teen girls before killing himself, police say. A convicted PFR this week allegedly fatally shot his wife and her 3 children in their Oklahoma home, as well as 2 teenage girls who were there for a sleepover before killing himself. Authorities found the bodies Monday at a property in Henrietta, a city about 90 miles from Oklahoma City, where a 39-year-old registered PFR Jesse McFadden lived with his wife, who was 35 years old, Holly McFadden, and her children, who were McFadden's stepchildren, and their names are given. I would definitely call this a terrible terrible tragedy, no?
Oh, we are very sad to hear about this here at FYP Education. There are no words that are adequate to express the emotions I feel, and I'm sure you feel, that something like this happened.
And how did they discover this, and why are we covering it?
Basically, I just wanted to say I'm sorry. You know, I'm afraid that this is going to result in a cataclysmic shift in terms of pretrial detention of PFRs in Oklahoma, because this is such a sensationalized story, and it will remain so. But they've discovered it because he was set to stand trial at 9 a.m. on the Monday. He didn't show up, and the charges were solicitation of a minor. And a bench warrant was issued for when he failed to show up, and authorities then discovered the bodies when they were executing a search warrant to try to find him. And they will definitely be proposals. There will definitely be proposals. I'll be shocked if they're not, that if a person's already on the PFR registry and they get accused of another crime, but they have to be held in pretrial detention. And that's the reason why we're covering it, because folks in Oklahoma, you need to sharpen your game because this is coming at you.
And I wanted to clarify the details, which you just did. So he was already on the registry and had been accused of something else. And he obviously didn't want to face the sentencing, the court and all that stuff. So he took matters into his own hands. But God, why did he drag everyone with him?
It's a tragedy.
Okay. And anything else there? We have one other thing to cover, and I think then it'll round out the hour.
All right, let's move on to the Peach State of Georgia.
Fantastic. Governor Brian Kemp signed a law Thursday that will increase penalties for repeat violent PFR-type people. Among other provisions, Miriam's law is named for an Atlanta woman, Miriam Abdul-Rab, sorry, I'm butchering that name, who was kidnapped and killed in 2021. According to a Georgia House release on the signing of the bill, House Bill 188, it also changes a state offender review board's risk assessment evaluation process and timelines for SVPs, and improves how the state handles PFRs who move to Georgia. The bill provides for a life prison sentence or split sentence of prison followed by probation for life for any person with a previous felony for PFR type thing who is convicted on a long list of crimes on a second occasion. The list will be shown in the notes. The law provides that any probation term shall also require monitoring.
The reason why I put this in here is because this is a deliberate attempt to get around the ruling of the Park case in Georgia, where they said they couldn't put the electronic monitoring on people after they had extinguished their sentence. So now they're going to put, now remember, this is the state that keeps a good close watch on every fiscal affair and expenditure, but they're going to lengthen the sentences so that they will have the ability to say, well, you have not extinguished your sentence, therefore you can have this. So they're going to, the law, as you pointed out, provides the probation term to also include electronic monitoring. And the list of the crimes is fairly long. So this yep. is, remember, fiscal responsible people, they keep a good eye on every expenditure.
I will say it is for people that have multiple offenses.
Well,
this kind of made the rounds with the Georgia folks and trying to fight stuff. And maybe there was some confusion about it, but it is for a somewhat isolated group of charges, and it has to be someone that has a multiple offenses. Cool. And this is not multiple charges at the time of the offense. This is something that you do at a later date, like as a second incident.
Correct. And if you've been convicted of one of these crimes on the list previously, the way I understood it, and you do it again, it doesn't have to be the same crime, but if you get a conviction now for one of these crimes and you've had a previous conviction for another crime on the list, the way I interpret it, then you would be subject to this. Yes. So you get your yep. second sexual offense in separate case from subsequent conduct, you'll end up in this predicament.
Very good, sir. Before we kick out of here, I would like to announce that we did get a new patron, and I will thank you very much, JP. We have a little bit of some history. And I thank you so much. You came in for an annual subscription using that $1,400 a month level from the stimulus money. So thank you very much, JP. And do you want to say that we got a new snail mail subscriber?
We did. We've been in a drought, but we got a new one named Nathan. And welcome, Nathan. He's subscribed for 20 years.
Say again?
No, I'm just kidding. He subscribed for, I think, 2 or 3 months.
Oh, okay. You said... And you cut out. Very good, very good. How do you think, let's see, how could we promote the transcription service, the snail mail thing? Everyone knows somebody that is locked up. So please tell all your people that are locked up about the subscription. You can they ask for like a freebie?
Sure. We send out freebies all the time. Absolutely.
How would they find us to get a freebie?
By knowing someone, or it's in the NARSL newsletter advertisement. It's in there every month telling them to write to us for a free one. And we do that. And sometimes through my generosity, even though I'm only intending to send them one, I get lazy and I leave their name on the list and they probably think we're crazy. And that may be why they don't pay for it, because I don't take them off after they get their freebie.
Very good. Otherwise, please head over to registrymatters.co. That's where you can download the podcast. And then over at FYP Education, that is where the transcripts are provided. If you want to do it on a DIY kind of level, you can print them out and mail them into your people in prison. If you want to do it that way as well, the PDFs of the transcript are posted up there eventually. And then, of course, thank you so much for becoming patrons, and all of you that are here in chat listening are patrons. And I can't thank you all enough. And you can find that over at patreon.com/registrymatters for as little as a buck a month. And it all helps to support this program and the content that we're creating. Anything else before we go, sir?
I think we're about to roll into a holiday for Sunday, which we should say happy holiday to that special person.
Oh, I was like, there's not a holiday this coming weekend? Oh, but yes, it is. Every one of us has a mother somewhere, or at least you did at some point in time. And you should thank that person very much for bringing you here, if that is a relationship that you have.
All right.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Larry. I hope you have a splendid evening and rest of your weekend. And I will talk to you, at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning? Is that 5 my time or 5 your time?
5 my time.
Okay. Very good. Take care, buddy.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.